Hey everybody, welcome back to Women Are Fort Wayne. I am here today with Anne-Marie Labenberg, the co-founder of Raise Consulting, a lifespan health advocacy consulting firm focused on underserved and underrepresented populations. Their primary areas of focus are women's health, maternal mortality, infant mortality, and the effects of the opioid crisis on all populations. You know, light topics.
You know.
So hi, Anne-Marie. Welcome.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for being here today.
Sure. Thank you for having me.
So you are also an ambassador for the United State of Women, which is described on their website as a national organization for any woman who sees that we need a different America for all women to survive and thrive and wants to work collectively to achieve it.
What a great statement that tells absolutely nothing about what the United State of Women does.
I am so curious because I checked out the website because you just recently got named
Correct.
To that ambassadorship. Mm-hmm. So what is the United State of Women?
Well, the basics behind the United State of Women, it was a group of individuals who basically looking at the same thing that you read there, that saw that there was a problem and wanted to do something about it. So this progressed into galvanized organizations that were done throughout the country. I became aware of and part of the organization's movement when they did Galvanize Ohio. And that was a location where they had great speakers. Galvanize has happened all over the country. Michelle Obama's been a speaker at it. They have breakout like leadership tracks or people who are in advocacy or if they're looking at campaign school and things like that, that they want to run for public office. They do these large organizations where hundreds of women come together and the sole focus of looking at gender equity. So the one thing that they don't talk about in there and the basis for it is conveying and amplifying the voices of those who are working in the gender equity space. So gender equity is a big, huge, massive topic. Mm-hmm. It can be anything from having representatives at the table. It can be looking at our racial inequities that we have and how do we make a difference in those outcomes. It's getting people who look more like us stepping into places of power in the legislature. So it's a pretty wide swath of things that are going on there. As an ambassador, the first one from Indiana ever, our goal is to try to find people who are already working in the women's equity, gender equity space, mm-hmm. and to be able to amplify the work that they're doing either on a national level or using resources as a way to amplify what they're doing or to be able to move them to a place where they have a larger audience.
I have to say, I'm relatively new to hearing it referred to as gender equity as opposed to women's rights or something like that. I really love that term. I love how inclusive it is, and I love how much it feels like rather than it being us against them, it's all of us sitting around the same table.
Right. And that is the big part of it. It's finding a way to convene all the intersections that happen in equity and doing something real about it. And part of that is collaboration. And part of that is understanding all the different things that individuals need to have going forward in order to be able to have an equitable outcome. A lot of times we talk about equality, and that's a big problem. Equality is giving everybody the same thing, but that doesn't mean that everybody gets the same outcome. So equity is looking at making sure that everybody has what they need to get the same outcome. That's a big part that has been a stumbling block in a lot of women's right issues, and a lot of the conversation is that we're worried about getting the same thing given to us, but what we really want is the same outcome. Nobody cares how you get there as much as they care about, do I get to get the same outcome?
You mentioned in our conversation last week the comic of equality versus equity, and I'll put that in the show notes. Do you want to describe that for our listeners?
Sure. So the comic that we're talking about, there is a fence and they're trying to watch a baseball game on the other side of the fence. And you have someone who can see over it, somebody who's looking into the middle of the fence, and then somebody who's down closer to the bottom. So equity is we give everybody one box. So
we have somebody, equality, you mean?
Equality, I should say. Equality is we give everybody one box. The person who didn't need a box in the first place gets a box. The person who just needed a boost to be able to see over, they get one box, now they can see. But the other person, one box didn't solve the problem. Equity is giving two boxes to the person who needs two boxes to be able to see over it, one to the person who needs one, and the person who doesn't need any assistance to see over the fence doesn't get anything, but it doesn't change their outcome, but changes the outcome of everybody else.
And we can see this play out in our society in a lot of different places.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. Gender equity is only one portion of that. There's so many other arenas where if we looked at equitable outcomes and not looking just at equality, we would be looking at having better outcomes for everybody all around.
And that's largely what you're doing with the United States of Women, is looking at that stuff.
Correct.
So what do you do with Raise Consulting?
Raise Consulting is a consulting firm that I started, really looking at how do we put together all the pieces of all the social justice issues that are going on, and how do we make a real impact? It's one thing to be angry because something isn't going the way it's supposed to be going. It's another thing to do something about it. So a big part of what Raise Consulting does is we do curriculum development. Again, our slogan is raising our voice for those who can't. So we use our privilege in the fact that I am a white, middle class, well-educated individual who has a voice that might be listened to more than someone who may be in a subjugated group. So the idea is because I have a voice and a platform, I have the opportunity to amplify the issues that are not being talked about necessarily in the same place. My backgrounds are in nursing, education, and strategic management, which is a weird combination of things to have, but that those synergies come together because our curriculum development that we do is looking at how do we train people to understand a particular topic that might be difficult to grasp. But then you have the opportunity to bring it to a place where everybody gets to understand. You don't get stuck in jargon. You aren't having people talking at things from stuff that they deal with every day that it's like, oh, well, this is the acronym we're using and nobody knows what it means. So our curriculums are meant for specific audiences that need to do that, whether it's mental health and explaining how trauma is the gateway drug, or if it's talking about how to have best outcomes for caring for people with dementia. They all have a common theme, which is if you don't give people the tools to be successful, they never will be.
So you just said something that I want to back up and talk about for a second.
Sure.
Trauma is the gateway drug.
So
what do you mean by that?
Well, one of the big things that we've looked at over the years, and when we look at the opioid crisis, it's a multifaceted problem, and there is no one size fits all thing. But in addiction, part of the thing that is different that people think about when they go is they assume that everybody has a free will choice when they come to addiction. Like someone just wakes up one day and says, you know what, I'm going to go become a heroin addict today. And that's not actually how things work.
Nobody thinks that.
So since nobody's going to choose to be a heroin addict, the choice piece of that has to have some background. Well, one of the things that we look at when we look at addiction, when we look at anxiety, depression, suicide, substance use disorder, it doesn't really matter. Trauma is the underpinning of those. So trauma can mean having a parent in prison. Trauma can mean a singular event that may be catastrophic. Sometimes it can be a lifetime of tragic events. Sometimes it can be a series of adverse childhood experiences that bring them to a place where they've learned bad habits or maladaptive. I like to think about them, that they aren't working to serve you, they serve against you. But those patterns and scripts that we learn over time, when this happens, that cause and effect of things, trauma can inherently trigger the opportunity for people to try to solve those problems in outside ways. They're not given the skills to adapt as they go forward. So when we look at addiction, if we were to pull out, there's adverse childhood experiences, it's called ACEs. So there's...
Is that a book?
It's a whole entire program that goes into this. But there's basically a short quiz test that can go through, and you look at the different pieces of that that say, did you have, live in insecurity as a child? Were you sexually assaulted? Were you physically hit by a parent? There's very specific wording to those, but they all look at different things that happen in childhood and how those affect people going forward. So just a simple thing, it's a score up to 10. And for someone who has an ACE score of 6 or greater, their propensity for having 20 years less of life is higher simply because they had those adverse childhood experiences.
Wow.
So someone whose regular lifespan, we'll just say, is 76. Uh-huh. We're just going average human being type of thing here. So say 76 is the average lifespan. Their average lifespan would be 20 years less than that. And this is because of the maladaptive skills that by having these multiple adverse childhood experiences without intervention. Now, this isn't saying that every person with a score of 6 is going to die 20 years earlier, but, it's kind of like Newton's law, right? An object in motion is going to stay in motion until something acts upon it. Well, if you're already going down a path that's maladaptive, you don't have any reason or any knowledge basis to even know that you need to leave that path.
Sure.
So that's without interventions, without programs that address those types of things that happen in childhood, and giving people the opportunity to understand perseverance and grit and giving them the tools to be successful in life. Without those, you're already on a less than stellar path, and you're going to continue to go down that path until something stops you.
So how does RAISE help with that? What do you do? You go in and you do these classes, these courses.
Right. So one of the big things we do with RAISE Consulting is implicit bias training. So one of the pieces of the puzzle that goes into that is looking at the fact that every person, and I mean every person, has a bias. There is not a soul that does not have a bias, because we're all evolutionarily built to have biases. And the biases can be good or bad. Everybody associates bias with being negative, but it doesn't have to be. We sometimes have biases towards positive things. Like some people are like, oh, they're just somebody that works out every day and that's part of their thing. And their bias may be against people who don't work out every day.
Mm-hmm.
Now, is that a positive bias? Not that they have a bias against people who don't exercise every day, but if that's all they ever knew growing up was exercise and doing all of those things, they were given tools that maybe somebody else wasn't.
Mm-hmm.
So they may go down that path. But most biases, and people associate them with the bad ones. So people that have a bias against a particular group. And this is the part that Project Implicit that Harvard University has a series of tests that you can take that look at where your biases are. And it looks at reaction times, because your evolutionary brain, your unconscious, whatever you want to call it, it makes those split second decisions. So in a moment where consciously you would not make a particular decision or you wouldn't choose something, unconsciously, your unconscious mind is handing you a decision, because in a split second, that's what it has to do. So it's kind of like, I tell people the easiest way to do this is name a movie you've seen recently.
Endgame.
Right. So why was it Endgame and not any of the other ones that you saw? And you had to sit there, and everybody does the same thing. They look up, or they look to the right or left, because they're going through the little Rolodex of stuff that's in the background, and they're being handed a response. It's the same thing that happens when you get a song stuck in your head, right?
Sure, yeah.
You aren't consciously saying, I want to get, Miley Cyrus's Wrecking Ball stuck in my head for the day, but that sometimes those things happen, right?
Uh-huh.
And those are the same kinds of things. There's different parts of your brain that are functioning on autopilot, and there's some pieces that when evolution says before, if you're doing something and you hear a rustling to your left, you better run right. You know, and if
you better run from that cheetah kind of
exactly.
reaction.
And if you didn't, you got eaten and then your genes didn't go on.
Right.
So evolution over time evolves for adaptive processes that keep you alive. Well, the same thing works in order to create your biases. So if every day you turn on the news and it tells you the same thing over and over and over and over and over again, you start associating A with B. So let's just say you turn on the TV and every day it tells you that somebody who robbed the bank had a red hat on. And every day somebody who had a red hat on committed a crime. So they robbed banks, they committed other felonies, all these things are happening, but it was always somebody with a red hat on it. They only ever talked about it when somebody with a red hat did it. So eventually, when you're out in public and you see somebody with a red hat, what do you associate them with?
Danger.
Exactly.
And you're going to get scared.
Exactly. So that's those are the scripts and patterns that happen over time. That's why it's important that we meter and monitor what we're feeding ourselves in the form of books and movies and television and radio and where you get your news and all that, because that frames the way you make decisions about people, because that's what evolution taught us to do.
What's interesting as I'm thinking about it is that I'm seeing how it plays on both sides. Like I'm seeing how it affects both people that are progressive and more conservative because of the news sources that they pay attention to.
Absolutely.
Like that, I can see how that's actually leading to some of the divisiveness that we're seeing in our country right now.
Well, and that's part of it too. I have a great graphic that I use when I teach implicit bias, and it shows the whole spectrum all the way from the most conservative, far right, radical conservative side, all the people that are on the fringe on the conservative side, all the way to the far left side. And there are people on the fringe on that side too.
Oh, yes.
And so what it does is it gives you an idea overall where those news sources fall on the spectrum.
Oh, that's useful.
So if you're looking for a moderate source, you pick the ones closest to the middle. Do we have anybody that's a straight up 100% no partisan bias, whatever? No. Some of them are going to have a slant towards certain things because that's in their ideology. But there are a scant few that run down the middle on either side that are about as close as you're going to get to impartial reporting.
Could I get that graphic from you for the show notes?
You sure can.
Fantastic. Thank you.
Yes.
And that's a great explanation of implicit bias. I don't think that I even had quite as clear of an understanding of it before hearing all of that. So when you go in and do these trainings, how do you teach this to people?
Well, one of the biggest things is one, we talk about the fact that everybody has biases, because inherently if we identify that we have a bias that is not popular, mm-hmm. that creates that internal conflict. Do I want to actually look at this? Do I want to understand this? Do I want to understand why I feel this way? Because there is a why that goes along with this. Somebody isn't born with the biases. It doesn't happen like that. There are circumstances, events, or scripts or narratives that we work through that eventually create those.
I would imagine the cognitive dissonance in your course of work is significant.
It is. And so one of the things that we do is everybody, before they come, they go out to Project Implicit and they take those series of tests.
And that's the Project Bias from Harvard?
The Project Implicit,
Is that something that anybody can take?
Anybody can take it.
Project Implicit.
Yes.
Okay, so I will make sure that there is a link to that in the show notes for anybody that's curious.
Yes. And so what we do is we have them do that up front. And everybody takes them. We take them. We have everybody's results. And we talk about the fact that you are not your bias. So we can't say, because you have a bias against, and we'll just use a popular one, say you have a bias that you associate black men with weapons, because that is one of the millions of ones that are on there. If you run into that, it doesn't mean you consciously necessarily do this, because it tests you by tapping in an order, and you have to associate pictures and things with good and bad, and they change it back and forth, whether good's your left hand or your right hand. but it looks at where that unconscious is. And it doesn't mean that you feel that way. Like, people are like, I don't feel that way. It's not about how you consciously feel. And this is where the disconnect happens, right? Because consciously, you may never dream of making a decision on something like that based solely on that. But unconsciously, when you have to make those split second decisions, when you're in a life or death, or I need to make this decision right now kind of thing, where does your body go for that? It goes based on patterns and scripts. So when those happen, you default to what you fed. So if you're watching television that tells you every time that something happens that black men are doing something with a dangerous weapon, a gun, a knife, if that's all you hear over and over again, and then you watch movies where over and over again that's the answer, and you read books when over and over again that's the answer, like, you're indoctrinating your unconscious mind with this pattern that says black men are associated with weapons. So you should not be surprised when that shows up on implicit bias. So the hardest thing for people to understand is that your bias has nothing to do with your value system or how you view the world. It's how you make decisions in the world when you don't have the luxury of time. So that's the problem. So part of what we do is we let them understand their biases, how those work, how the brain works, so they understand that they're not choosing it. Your bias is not something you choose. You can choose to continue to feed a bias, but once you're aware of your bias, your opportunity is to step outside of that and go, oh my gosh, I like totally made that decision based on, when you know them, you'll recognize them when you do them. Then you'll learn to practice the pause. It's one of the best tools you can give anybody when they're working through bias is give your conscious mind time to step into the capacity to catch up with that unconscious decision. So before you make a big decision about something, practice the pause. Why am I feeling this way? Why am I making this decision? When you know your biases and you see yourself making a decision that rings in the bias, then you have to question, am I just making this decision in general? Is there some outside force that I'm doing it? Or is this simply because this is what I've been conditioned to think? Those are where you make the changes. And then after that, you change your script. You change where you get your news sources from. You engage with people who are in groups that you have a bias with so that you can put humanity to a bias. Because mm-hmm. that's when you change things.
Can I go on a slight tangent for a second?
You may.
Going back to, you asked me what movie I've watched recently. And so, of course, Endgame was in my head as you were saying all of that. And it made me think how incredibly powerful it is right now that Hollywood is doing what it's doing to be more inclusive and to represent more people. Because when I think about what characters in that movie are heroes, there's some white people, but there's black people, there's women, there's a very, very wide, diverse cast that are all literally heroes. And they're all literally showing in representation that, like, they're building those positive associations. And I'm seeing that everywhere right now.
Well, and you'll see more of that because as more people become aware that what you feed yourself is what you get for outcomes, mm-hmm. you're going to see more of those because that diversity is what America is. Mm-hmm. I mean, we don't only exist in white males.
And not just America, but
well,
global.
Everywhere. But yeah. That's the extra special portion of that is because in a lot of countries, they may be more homogeneous in their racial structure, and having the opportunity to see that diversity coming from the United States, when for the longest time, if you were black, you were the criminal or the maid or the help or whatever. Now we have a whole entire movie based on the fact that you can be non-white and be amazing. These are things we can teach people outside of our contiguous states.
So you go in these and you do these trainings. What are some of the other things that you do with RAISE?
Our curriculum development is based on bringing the information to where people are at. I do tons of public speaking, so a lot of that may be best practices, getting things into rural settings. I mean, in healthcare in general, from innovation to implementation and a widespread makes it to every nook and cranny of the country, is about 15 to 17 years. Let that sink in for a hot second.
Wow.
So in Indiana, there has been a lag that's been further in a lot of circumstances because there's some things we do here that are different. We don't require continuing ed for nurses. So as
really?
An RN, when I graduated, I never once had to ever do another continuing ed simply to be able to maintain my RN license.
That's a little bit astonishing because the medical industry is changing constantly.
Well, it's one of the reasons why I write a white paper on a regular basis to the Indiana State Department of Health about the fact that we need to do something about that. Now, I do feel like that's coming because we're working towards the idea of being part of the nurse licensure pact, which means that our license would be good in other states, but that means we all have to make it to a similar level. Mm-hmm. And I can guarantee you continuing ed is going to be part of that. So I think that might be coming down the pike, but realistically, a lot of people have to have certifications and you have to do continuing ed for that. But it's simple things like pregnant women show up in every form of healthcare. You can break your arm and be pregnant. You can be in a car accident and be pregnant. You can have gallstones and be pregnant. You can have a sinus infection and be pregnant. So we have access to multiple areas. But the problem is we don't require maternity information to be disseminated into like ERs. Or they're just like looking at you as, oh, you're a person with XYZ. Well, sometimes we miss factors, whether it's preeclampsia, there's a ton of different things that happen with women in pregnancy. And just the simple fact that we don't have comprehensive education on maternity and prenatal and postnatal care, we've often missed things because women and men do not present the same way. Even just a simple part of having a heart attack, the traditional symptoms of a heart attack with the crushing chest pain and all of those things that happen, for men, women don't have those.
Really?
So women have a whole different set. They'll have anxiety. It'll present like indigestion. Like there's all these different presentations.
Huh.
So you can imagine being pregnant on top of all of those things and all the things that happen in pregnancy where you're going to have swelling and you have a higher blood volume and all these different things that can happen. And so they get pawned off as being consequences of pregnancy when really they're precursors to very serious events, but people get sent home. Now, I'm not saying that's an everyday occurrence and it's not necessarily something that's indigenous here to Fort Wayne, but it's a systemic problem in the United States at the very minimum.
And it's worse here because of the lack of continuing education.
Absolutely. It's certainly not going to add any value by not having individuals who can potentially, maybe they work in a doctor's office and there's no reason for them to have specific certifications and they're not catching something when somebody talks to the phone nurse.
So you've mentioned a couple of times these white papers that you create.
Mm-hmm.
Could you share for anybody who doesn't know, me included, like what exactly are, like, what are these for? What do you do with them? Who reads them? And what impact are they having?
So the idea behind a white paper is to take a topic or a problem or a perceived problem and break it down to the why of the why of the why. So looking at root cause analysis. As a nurse, that's what we're taught to do. We don't just look at the overlying symptom that we might have there. We start asking questions till we get down to the base reason. Somebody may be coming in and may have all these symptoms, but it might be because they had to sleep outside last night and they haven't eaten since last Tuesday. The problem isn't necessarily the symptom that's there. If you don't solve the other two problems, the symptoms are just going to continue to resurface.
Sure, that makes sense.
So the idea behind the white paper is to take all of it, look at the statistics of whatever it is. So we'll take like our maternal and infant mortality. I wrote a white paper a couple of years ago looking before we ever got our maternal mortality review committee implemented, looking at statistically, we're in the bottom 10 for every women's health initiative under the sun. We have money, we have access, we have lots of things that are available for this, but we still weren't getting to the certain place that we needed to. So we looked at states that did a great job and how did they, like California halved their infant and maternal mortality in like a 7-year period.
Mm-hmm. That's incredible.
And so that happened because they made a concerted effort to look at all of the factors associated with it, not taking a unilateral approach where we only address one thing. And then when that's better 10 years from now, we'll address the next thing, because it's a long process that way. So they developed all kinds of things. So part of that was looking at states that are doing a good job. What do they have in place? What did they learn? And where are we, and what are the lessons we need to learn from this?
Okay.
So most of them are informative of what best practices are, what next steps may want to, that we may need to have. And sometimes they're even just informative on things that people just don't understand. So trauma is another one that we did, because again, trauma being the gateway drug, people don't recognize is that nobody opts in to be a drug addict.
Mm-hmm.
I don't even like the words. People who have substance use disorder, because it's an organic thing. So It's not like somebody opts in for having diabetes. Again, this is something, if somebody has type 1 diabetes, we don't have any problem with giving them insulin if they're having an issue. And it may be the fifth time they had an issue. Same thing with substance use disorder.
So once you've written these white papers, what then?
It depends on what they're for. Sometimes they're commissioned. So sometimes I'll have an organization that is looking to make a difference or wants to make a change, or sometimes for legislators that are looking to introduce legislation so that they have the opportunity to have some statistical backup.
And is that on a city level, on a state level,
depends.
On a national level?
I've done it on pretty much every level. So
that's awesome.
I've done it all over. A lot of times they're written and they're disseminated through either other interested parties who would benefit from having the information. A lot of times they're great for people who are looking to apply for grants to make a difference in a particular topic, because then they have the hard facts to back up the programming that they're looking to do.
So I know that you've been working on a white paper recently.
Yes.
Are you ready to talk about that, or would you prefer not to?
We can talk about it a little bit. We'll do maybe 35,000 feet on this one, so it doesn't get down into the weeds. But
okay.
Sometimes, I don't know, how do you diplomatically say this? Sometimes people have great intentions when they look at doing a program, and it sounds great on paper, but it doesn't work out really well in the execution. So there is a program that's going to start, and one of the biggest problems is that its basis is telephonic. So basically, they're making phone calls to people that aren't going to know who they are to give them suggestions on things they should do in their care.
And this is a legislated program, right?
Correct. So this is something that's been fully funded, and understand it's in our state budget for $6.6 million over 2 years. So this isn't just...
That's a lot of money.
This isn't just like, oh, we're spending, you know, $6,000 here to do something. This is a monumental program. And while my job is never to bash another program, because somebody's trying to do something, so like something is better than nothing, but we already have programs that are in place that provide the services that they're looking for, and they have great outcomes. So my question in this was a quest to understand exactly what they wanted to accomplish by doing this program and denying some additional money to some of these other programs. So as diplomatically as I can place that information in there, because we're still in fact gathering, there's still some information we need to do. And again, the idea is for people to work together. So I'm all about collaboration. My biggest pet peeve is that a lot of times we work in silos. Mm-hmm. So instead of talking about where we're at working on a project or what services would be best, or if you're already doing something, why would I want to start doing something else? But there tends to be a lot of ego that happens, particularly when it comes to grant money, because that's a tough row to hoe for most people. I think it'd probably be a lot simpler if we didn't have that. So part of the idea behind the white papers, when they're about current events and things that are happening in our state or region, it's really about, can everybody look at this and see that this is probably not the best way to solve this by having two people doing the exact same project but not talking to one another?
Sure.
So that there's a lot of duplication of services that happen, where if people just put the time, effort, energy, and money, most importantly, into those situations, they'd have a much better outcome.
So when do you foresee yourself being done with this white paper?
My hope is to have it done in the next 2 weeks. We're just waiting for some last details before I put all of it together, because realistically, it's not necessarily doom and gloom. The idea is that, like, if we're going to do this, like, why are we, how do we use that $6.6 million, which is our state budget? So for those of you who are there here in Indiana, you're paying for this. So if it's going to be in our state budget and we're going to give that kind of money to something, what is it based on? Is there any evidence that that's a best practice? I think those should have been questions that we asked before we awarded $6.6 million.
Absolutely. So before you started doing all of this, you were running a home care agency.
Yes.
And then a few years ago, what year was it that you started Raise?
2016.
Cool. So you've accomplished a lot in a pretty short period of time, it sounds like.
Well, part of it's because this is, social justice has been my background for like all of my life, I think, or most, the vast majority, all of my adult life anyway. So I think some of the connections that I had from previous experiences helped to catapult some of that. I know that that's a big part of it. So, I've cultivated a lot of relationships in the 20 years that I've been here in Fort Wayne.
So what sparked you to get into social justice work? How did you come to that path?
Well, you know, everybody talks about when they had a moment that something happened. And I think everybody pretty much has a galvanizing moment, especially in social justice. Something happens that sparks that. It's not so much that people can't walk into social justice just on the idea that this is the way the world is supposed to work. But I think most of us have had some sort of galvanizing moment. When I was 8 years old, we moved from Connecticut into the Eastern Shore of Maryland. Not the current Eastern Shore, it's in a much different place now, but back in 1983, ooh, that just said how old I was. back in 1983, we moved there, and we had only a garage door opener to go around. My dad hadn't even gotten a new key, but my mom and my brother and I were out running around, and we decided to get all the things you need to do when you start a new house. And our last stop was at the grocery store, and we had a huge basket. It's, you know, the toilet paper, salt and pepper, ketchup run, right? So you have to have everything under the sun. And there was a woman that was in line in front of us, and she stepped out of line and told us that we should go ahead. And she had like 8 items and we have like 800. And I couldn't quite understand why she would want to. And I'm like, no, you have like 8 items, go ahead. And she's like, no, you need to go ahead. And my mom kind of like kicked me, and I was like, okay, well, I'm not going to get in trouble for this one. So she went in front of us. Fast forward. And I didn't really, I mean, I thought it was ridiculous, but I didn't think anything of it at the time because, you know, I'm 8. Fast forward 2 months later, I go to a school that is predominantly minority. As a white female, I am the minority in this school. And you're going to turn 9 and you're a girl. And so, like, what are you going to do? You have a sleepover because that's what you do for your birthday when you're 9. Mm-hmm. And so, and it's February, so it's not like you're going to want to go too far and do stuff, right? So
not exactly going to be outside swimming or something.
Correct. And so I had invited my best friend from school, and then there were some other girls from the neighborhood that were coming to the party as well, because where we lived at, most of the people I lived near went to private school. They did not go to the school with us. So one day my mom gets a phone call from one of the neighbor's daughters and or one of the neighbor's mothers, and she's like, is insert my friend Andrea going to be there? And my mom's like, well, yeah, I mean, she was invited, I'm assuming she's coming. And she's like, yeah, well, my daughter's not coming. And those phone calls kept coming and coming and coming. And then I, with all nearly 9 years old of myself at that time, recognized the fact that Andrea was Black and all of these other girls were white. And I realized just how freaking ridiculous that was. And as such, I decided nobody was coming except for Andrea. And then I realized in that same moment that that's why the woman got out of line, because the woman who had to get out of line was also Black. This is 1983. This isn't 1963. This is 1983. And so coming from New England, where none of that would have dreamed of happening in my presence and anything I would have had to do, I didn't have any frame of reference to understand what was transpiring. I didn't figure it out until I realized just how horrible all of these people were being, simply because a little girl who happened to be Black was going to be in our home. And at that moment, I realized I never wanted anybody to ever have to feel like that again. So that unfortunate set of circumstances set a long precedent of not accepting or tolerating people's inability to understand we're all human beings, first and foremost.
So flash forward a number of years, and you decided to start Raise. What makes you do the work that you do today?
So when I had the home care agency, we were a Medicaid-only home care agency for the last umpteen years of having the agency, and my predominant area that we served was the southeast side of Fort Wayne, mainly because these were not necessarily the most upscale locations to go into. There are places you hear things about on the news, and a lot of places would not service people who lived in those areas. And so I went into home care very specifically because I knew that people deserved to have better than what they got in home care. Not to say there aren't great home care providers, I'm not saying that, but many people just sent any warm body to provide care, and that was never my intention. We did dedicated staffing, we had regular people who were coming to see people, and at the end of the day, I didn't really care. I mean, I've had multiple instances where people are like, why are you doing that? There was a shooting down the street, there was this or whatever, but that was never the point. The point was is that there were individuals who needed our care who happened to live in these areas, and they deserved to have somebody who cared about their outcomes coming to their house. So that's part of where, you know, Raise is built out of, the idea that there's a lot of work we have to do. It's not insurmountable, but it's work we have to do. And part of the privilege I have, as I said before, is being a white, middle-class, well-educated person, is I have a voice that not necessarily gives me the authority, but it gives me a place to be able to talk about the things that happen in different locations or to different populations without fear of retribution, the same way that someone who's living that life would have to worry about.
There was a wonderful story that I saw going around social media a year or two ago, explaining privilege to a classroom of kids. And it had the exercise that the teacher had the kids do was that everybody had to crumple up a piece of paper, and he put a trash can at the front of the room. Are you familiar with this one?
Oh, I'm not.
Oh, it's really good. So he puts the trash can at the front of the classroom, and everybody in the room has to crumple up paper and throw it at the trash can. And he says that to get an A, you have to get the paper in the trash can. So the people in the front row can do this pretty easily. And some of the people in the second row can. But once you get to the third or the fourth row, all of a sudden, they're not able to get the paper anywhere close to the trash can. And they start saying that this is not fair, this is not fair, this is not fair. And he's like, exactly. Because it's not something that's set up for everybody. And somebody in the back of the room says, well, or somebody in the front of the room raises their hand and says, well, it's not fair that I get an A and the people in the back don't. What can we do about this? And the teacher says, if you're in the front row, it's your job to change the game.
Exactly. And it goes back to the thought process we had about equity in that. It's the same thing. Equality is everybody has something they can throw and everybody gets one shot to throw it at there. That's equality. Mm-hmm. Equity is everybody gets to do it from the front row.
Yeah. So if people are wanting to learn more about these topics or take some action after hearing our conversation today, do you have any recommendations of where they can go or what they could read or watch?
It depends on where they're wanting to go with that. Certainly we're a repository where we can, certainly if people have interest or need information about specific topics, specifically if it's underserved, underrepresented, implicit bias, that's our bread and butter. So that's what we do every day. So we have lots of resources that we can send out. So if somebody has a particular topic they want to learn more about, I have a whole set of resources for them.
And where can they find you online?
Our website is www.raiseourvoice.org.
And are you on social media at all?
All over the place. There's some version of Raise Our Voice on Instagram, Twitter, Facebook, LinkedIn, so we can get all that information so you can have it in the show notes.
Wonderful. Thank you so much.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you so much for joining us today. This has been a really amazing and enlightening conversation. And I know that we could talk on like 20 other topics really, really easily. So I'm sure that we'll have you back at some point.
All right. That sounds great. Thank you for having me.
All right.